From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the book that may be the first novel written by a black woman and the first by a fugitive slave. We talk with Henry Louis Gates about authenticating and editing the manuscript after buying it at an auction. The novel, The Bondwoman's Narrative, has just been published with an introduction by Gates. He's the chair of Harvard's African American Studies Department. Also, filmmaker Jon Favreau, the writer and star of the movies Swingers and Maid. He created and hosts a new talk show series on the Independent Film Channel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 13 Israeli soldiers were killed today in an ambush by Palestinian fighters. It's the worst single blow to the Israeli army in a year and a half. The BBC's James Reynolds reports from an Israeli army camp near Jenin.
It is a serious loss for the Israeli army, its heaviest in 18 months of violence in this land. Army commanders at this base have now given details of what happened. They say the soldiers were killed when a suicide bomber detonated explosives strapped to his body. The attack came during a period of intense fighting in Jenin. Israeli officials say the fighting's been concentrated in the town's refugee camp. And there's been house-to-house combat, the most intense of Israel's current military campaign in the West Bank. And it's not yet clear how many Palestinians have been killed in fighting in Jenin. Israeli security sources indicate it may be as many as 150. Palestinians suggest it may be more. They say ambulances have still not been able to reach those who've been injured.
The BBC's James Reynolds reporting. Secretary of State Colin Powell has arrived in Spain, where he's scheduled to discuss the Middle East conflict with leaders from the European Union, Russia, and the UN. The secretary will head for Jordan and Israel later this week for talks with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The former Arthur Andersen accountant who oversaw the audits of failed energy giant Enron Corporation has pleaded guilty to illegally destroying documents and directing others to do the same. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
It's believed David Duncan is the first to strike a deal with federal prosecutors in the Enron investigation. In court, the former auditor described how he ordered Andersen employees to destroy Enron-related documents, even though he knew a federal probe was underway. Andersen fired Duncan earlier this year, but the firm also faces a criminal charge of obstructing justice. Fordham University law professor Dan Richman says whether the Duncan guilty plea puts new pressure on Andersen is an open question.
It sounds like Andersen didn't wake up this morning shocked to find that Mr. Duncan was ready to plead guilty. I think that this entered into their calculations all the way through.
Duncan is scheduled to be sentenced later this month. His lawyers say he will continue to cooperate with the government. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
Federal prosecutors in New York City have indicted a lawyer and three other people on charges of helping an imprisoned terrorist communicate with a terrorist group. Attorney Lynn Stewart is accused of helping Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman exchange messages with the Islamic Group, an organization based in Egypt. Abdul Rahman is a Muslim cleric who's currently serving a life prison sentence for plotting to bomb five New York City landmarks. In stocks today, the Dow lost 40 points to close at 10,208. The NASDAQ lost 43. This is NPR News. President Bush predicted today that Iraq will be alone in its decision to suspend oil exports for 30 days to protest Israel's military operations in the West Bank. Iraq said yesterday that it would stop exporting oil for 30 days or until Israel withdraws from Palestinian-controlled lands. President Bush said the Iraqi oil stoppages show how important it is to diversify U.S. oil supplies away from places like Iraq. Alaska Senator Frank Murkowski said it's an example of why the government should allow oil companies to drill in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The cost of a first-class stamp will be going up this summer. The Postal Service has set a date for this and other rate hikes. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
The Postal Service says first-class stamps will cost more beginning June 30th. They'll rise by 3 cents to 37 cents. But it's not the only rate hike. For example, 1 pound priority mail will cost an extra 35 cents to send. 8 ounce express mail will cost another $1.20. Rates for postcards will rise by 2 cents. Certified mail goes up by a dime, and sending a 2 pound parcel post will cost another 69 cents. The increases come as the Postal Service tries to overcome some big budget problems. It lost $1.6 billion last year, prompting job cuts and a halt to new construction. The figure doesn't include the millions of dollars lost after last September's terrorist attacks and the anthrax attacks through the mail. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Delegations of leaders and rulers from around the world took part in the funeral of Britain's Queen Mother today. The funeral took place in Westminster Abbey, and the funeral procession made its way to Windsor Castle. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients manage business performance through business consulting, application development and integration, and application outsourcing. Keen, we get IT done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Henry Louis Gates, has edited a manuscript that was written in the 1850s by Hannah Crafts, a woman who described herself as a runaway slave and described the manuscript as a novel based on her life. If the author is who she says she was, then this book would be the first known novel written by a black woman and the first by a fugitive slave. Crafts' novel, The Bondwoman's Narrative, is filled with descriptions of slave life in the mid-1800s. It's just been published with an introduction by Gates that describes the process he has been using to authenticate the manuscript. He bought the handwritten manuscript at an auction of African-American writings. It was from the private collection of the late Dorothy Porter Wesley, who had been a historian and librarian at Howard University. Henry Louis Gates is the chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. I asked him about the significance of the manuscript.
The most exciting thing about this manuscript for me is the fact that it exists. The fact that a woman ran away from slavery in North Carolina, made it all the way to New Jersey, sat down and wrote a fictional account, a novelistic account of her experience in bondage, didn't publish it for reasons that we don't understand, and yet, 150 years later, this manuscript emerges, it has survived, and now has made itself into print. It's a miracle. I mean, I can't believe it. I mean, sitting here looking at the book, I can't believe it. And I hope that it leads scholars and students to look more diligently for other unpublished manuscripts and other lost works by persons of color, and particularly by women of color.
Let's start with the text itself. Can you tell us a little bit the story that the novel tells?
Well, it's a story of a woman who is a mulatto, and she is working in a very grand estate in Virginia. And the man to whom she is enslaved is marrying a new bride. And the new bride comes in, and everyone's all excited. They're about to have a wedding, but there's a shadow over the new bride. And it turns out that the shadow is the shadow of blackness. The new mistress, as it turns out, is passing for white. So it's a double passing tale. The mistress is passing for white, and she, of course, is unveiled by the evil Mr. Trapp, a Dickensian character, if I've ever heard of one. And She and her favorite slave, our Hannah Crafts, try to run away through Virginia and Milton, Virginia, which became very, very important fact in authenticating her tale. But she never can escape, and she expires in the manner of a true sentimental heroine, you know, anguished, and so she just dies. And then the rest of the novel is about our Hannah Crafts and her experiences in other plantation households in Virginia, then being purchased by the evil Wheeler family and taken to Washington, D.C., and then moving with them to North Carolina, where Mrs. Wheeler, in punishment, attempts to force her effectively to be raped by a black field hand. And that's when she runs away, and she adopts the disguise of a white male. She dresses as a boy. She's very fair, and she uses that to escape.
You have read a lot of literature about slavery, and you've read a lot of slave narratives. Are there descriptions in this book that are unlike things you've read before, that give you insights into what slave life was like?
You know, that's one of the most striking things about this novel. Rather than stick merely to the details of slavery, this author will take time to talk about the flora, the fauna, the architecture, but also she has tremendous insight into the subtle effects of slavery on a slave. For example, Frederick Douglass says the most important thing about being a slave was not knowing your birth date. Now, that's counterintuitive. Who would figure that out? You would think, I always ask my classes every year, what's the worst thing about slavery? And they'd say, being beaten or being raped. Douglass says the worst thing is that he never knew his birth date. So it's surprising what was important in the life of a slave.
I'd like you to choose a passage from the bondwoman's narrative that you think, you know, illustrates something interesting about her perception of slavery. And tell us why you've chosen this passage.
Okay, I'd like to read from chapter 16, which is called In North Carolina. And remember, it's from North Carolina that she will finally make her escape. And like the other chapters, it starts with an epigraph. This one is from the Bible, the book of Esther. We are sold for naught, I and my people. And here she's describing, contrasting life within the big house to life within the quarters out in the field. And what's interesting about that is that in the slave narratives, we have very few vivid descriptions of the squalid nature of life in the huts, as she calls them, life in the slave quarters. Often slave narrators were, if they didn't edit themselves, they were rather euphemistic. And she's much more direct than any other slave narrator that I know. But notice that she combines the physical description, as it were, with the metaphysical description of the cost or effects of slavery upon the slaves. Many of these huts were even older than the nation and had been occupied by successive generations of slaves. The greatest curse of slavery is its hereditary character. The father leaves to his son an inheritance of toil and misery and his place on the fetid straw in the miserable corner, with no hope or possibility of anything better. And the son, in his turn, transmits the same to his offspring, and thus forever. If the huts were bad, the inhabitants, it seemed, were still worse. Degradation, neglect, and ill treatment had wrought on them its legitimate effects. All day they toil beneath the burning sun, scarcely conscious that any link exists between themselves and other portions of the human race. Their mental condition is briefly summed up in the phrase that they know nothing. They know indeed that it is hard to toil unceasingly for a scanty pittance of food and coarse garments. Nature instructed them thus far.
Now, the main character in the story is actually lives, is a house slave and not a field slave, yes?
Yes, that's right. She's a very privileged, very opinionated, very literate house slave who goes to great lengths to show us how she gained her education. That is, how she was able to write the narrative that you're holding in your hands.
Now, at one point in the story, she's being forced to have a sexual relationship with a field slave who she doesn't like. And it's her owner who's forcing her to do this.
The evil Mrs. Wheeler, Mrs. John Hill Wheeler, in punishment, attempts to force her to sleep with a field hand, a person she describes in very vivid language as being uneducated and bad-smelling and foul. And, you know, if it weren't so tragic, it would be comic as the vividness of her description. And this is what finally forces Hannah to run away. Well, and she equates this forced marriage with rape.
Let's talk about the authentication process for this book. One of the first things you wanted to verify was that the author was, in fact, an African-American woman. Is that difficult to authenticate? How do you go about trying to authenticate that?
Well, it's the first thing that you do, of course, is to look through the censuses for someone called Hannah Craft. And she has an S on her name, so it's Hannah Crafts. Now, I was recovering from a series of hip replacement surgeries. I had a hip replacement when I was 39, and it was worn out, and so I had to have what was supposed to be a routine replacement of a replacement. But 3 months after the operation, I was rushed to the hospital at dawn, and it had become infected, and so I didn't have a hip. For 3 months, I had no hip. And while they cured the infection, then they put the hip back in. So basically, I lost a year of my life, and I was stuck at home. I didn't have a whole lot to do. And I read about this manuscript in the Swan Gallery's auction catalog. They have an annual Black History Month auction, and their item number 30 was this manuscript. And so I bought it through a friend. I sent a person I know, and we bid on it, and we got it. So the first thing I did, when I read it, I was convinced that the author was black. So I had to try to find her. But I couldn't leave the house, effectively. I was on crutches. And so I contacted several librarians over the course of the next 6 months to help me with the research. I had so many false starts and dead end to leads. I found thousands of people named Hannah Crafts in the various censuses, but none was an African-American, and none lived in New Jersey with the exception of one Hannah Crafts who appears in the 1860 census in Somerset County, New Jersey. She just appears out of the blue, but she's listed as white, which led me to conclude, as you know from the introduction, that our Hannah Crafts could possibly, we know she was a mulatto, she could have shown up in New Jersey and passed for white, which would explain why she had never published this manuscript. But on the other hand, we established a tremendous amount of other facts from the book. For example, she mentions that she and her mulatto mistress, the woman who was exposed by the evil Dr. Trapp, had tried to escape from Lindendale, the plantation in Virginia. And they go to a place called Milton, Virginia, which is on the James River. And she mentions the names of maybe six slaveholders. Well, like the Henry family, the Cosgrove family, a man named Frederick Hawkins. I had made a list of all the proper names in the book. Then I went to the United States censuses for 1810, 1820, 1830, 1840, 1850, 1860. And do you know, everyone that she mentions, except for the two Dickensian characters, Mr. Trapp and Mr. Sadler, everyone she mentions actually existed within a 50-kilometer radius of Milton, Virginia. Now, if this were, say, an upper-class white person writing from the North, purely fictionalizing an imaginary slave's experience, there's no way they would have known the identity of all these slaveholders within a 50-mile radius of Milton, Virginia. This was the first positive information that I was able to glean from the novel. Then, of course, the most important, of course, was identifying John Hill Wheeler, the Mr. Wheeler and Mrs. Wheeler, who are so important to the plot of the book.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. The manuscript we're discussing has just been published. It's called The Bondwoman's Narrative. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Henry Louis Gates. He's edited the manuscript that may be the first known novel written by a black woman and the first by a fugitive slave. Gates has just published it with his introduction. It's called The Bondwoman's Narrative by Hannah Crafts. In authenticating the manuscript, Gates found that two of the slave owners in the novel, John Hill Wheeler and his wife, appear to be based on real people of the same name. What were you able to learn about the real Wheeler family?
Well, I became intrigued with the identity of the Wheelers once I read Dr. Joe Nichols' report.
And he's the authenticator who actually tries to figure out from the ink and from the paper when it was written, and he even analyzes the penmanship to see what he could learn about that, analyzes the grammar.
That's right. Joe Nichols played a crucial role in exposing the Jack the Ripper diary fraud. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And he's the world's expert on pen and ink evidence. And so his report pointed out several interesting aspects of the writing of this book. And one was that she most probably knew someone named Wheeler, because initially in the novel she writes his name as WH-R, you know, in the manner of 18th and 19th century novels. But then she goes back and fills in the whole name, adding the rest of the word Wheeler. And he argued that this suggested that the fact that she did this meant that she knew someone named Wheeler. Well, this manuscript had emerged from the collection of the great librarian Dorothy Porter Wesley. And in her notes, which I received when I bought the manuscript, she had said that a minor official named John Hill Wheeler occupied several government positions in the 1850s and 1860s in Washington, D.C. So I began to think about John Hill Wheeler, who he could possibly be. So I found out that the only Wheeler living in America in 1850 and 1860, the only one who lived both in Washington, D.C. and in North Carolina, was John Hill Wheeler. And then the world's greatest scholar of the slave narratives, my colleague William Andrews down in the Department of English at the University of North Carolina, who's published the definitive book on the slave narratives, called me one day and said, did I realize that John Hill Wheeler had played a pivotal role in the famous case of Passmore Williamson? And this turned out to be the smoking pistol that I'd been looking for.
In what case?
John Hill Wheeler owned a slave named Jane Johnson. John Hill Wheeler was the minister of the United States government to Nicaragua between 1854 and about 1856-57. He was finally fired from that position for contravening orders. But he was carrying his slave, who had two sons, with him from Washington to Nicaragua via Philadelphia and New York. They had to go up to New York, catch a boat, and then sail to Nicaragua. They stop in Philadelphia. This is the year's 1855. It's the summer. It's July of 1855. And he says to Jane Johnson, you sit here in the lobby of this hotel. I'm going in and have dinner, you and your boys. Now, if any of these colored waiters, now remember, Philadelphia is a hotbed of anti-slavery sentiment. The Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society is based in Philadelphia, founded by Benjamin Franklin, of course, in 1790. And she says, if any of these colored waiters who are hovering around here ask you if you were a slave, you say either, no, I'm a free colored person, or I'm a slave and I don't want to be free. And so he goes and sits down to eat his meal. But he's tricking her because he pretends to sit down and then he jumps up and creeps back into the lobby of the hotel to see if she's talking to any of the black waiters. And she's not. So then he goes and he's comfortable and he eats his meal. As soon as he sits back down, she runs over to one of the other black waiters and says, help me, I'm a slave, I'm a slave, I want to be free. So they send a message over to the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society to a black man named William Still, who's very famous because he eventually published a book called The Underground Railroad in 1872. He and Passmore Williamson, who is the Quaker, who is the president of the Anti-Slavery Society, go together to the hotel. She and Wheeler have already left for the boat. They run down to the boat. They get onto the boat, and they wrestle with Wheeler, and they steal Jane Johnson away. They liberate Jane Johnson. Well, when I read the case of Passmore Williamson after Bill Andrews told me about this, I thought about an odd passage in the novel. In the novel, when Mrs. Wheeler comes to Virginia and buys Hannah Crafts, she says to Hannah, will you do my hair? And Hannah's doing her hair, and she's hurting her hair, and her scalp is very sensitive. And she complains about her hairdressing abilities. And then she says, I haven't been able to have my hair done decently since Jane ran away. And that Jane was Jane Johnson. That was the smoking pistol. And I knew that this was real. I mean, I knew that Hannah Crafts had been a servant of John Hill Wheeler and that Jane Johnson was the slave that preceded her. It was a remarkable discovery. I mean, it was, I got tears in my eyes when I read it. It was so exciting.
You've really had to be a detective with this.
Well, it was just trying to be a good historical scholar, but there is an aspect of that to it. It's exciting. It's intriguing. I became obsessed. You know, remember, I'm confined to home, essentially. I have nothing else to do but watch the Chad count. the Supreme Court robbed me of my one pleasure. I mean, in addition to my own personal political predilections, I had filled my day with watching CNN, watching the Chad count. I mean, I would have gone down and counted the Chad with him. I was so bored. So all of a sudden, I had a project. And for between February 15th of last year, the day I purchased the manuscript, and the end of August when I finished writing the introduction, all I did was think about the identity of Hannah Crafts and the peculiar structure of this book. It was exciting. I mean, in a way, my illness was a blessing because I wouldn't have had the time to devote to such an arduous process. I mean, it's a very detailed kind of work.
What are the questions remaining for you to investigate before you can say definitively who Hannah Crafts was?
Well, I can say definitively, in my opinion, that Hannah Crafts was an African-American and a woman and a slave. I can't say where she lived in New Jersey or if indeed she lived in New Jersey. I can't say to whom she got married, a man she claims was a Methodist minister. I can't say where she wrote this book. And most disappointing of all to me, I can't say what happened to her after she escaped to the North. I've reached a dead end, which is why, Terry, I published the book now. I think that other students, other scholars, genealogists, I'm starting to get emails from, every day I get emails from genealogists who say, I went to this cemetery and I found this Hannah Crafts. And then I look at their evidence and Hannah Crafts died in 1793. And I said, well, maybe if you read the book, you realize this could not possibly be my Hannah Crafts. But sooner or later, someone will find Hannah Crafts. And I think they will find her in New Jersey. And the reason is she says that she ended up in New Jersey. And in 1948, Dorothy Porter buys the book from a book dealer in New York who says that she had bought it from a traveling book scout in New Jersey. Now, there's no reason for that manuscript to have emerged in New Jersey if the woman hadn't written it in New Jersey, as she said. The other reason is that none of the other slave narrators end their novels or their autobiographies in New Jersey. It's very unusual to do that. But as it turns out, New Jersey was a terminal point on the Underground Railroad. And there were six or seven all-black communities in New Jersey, even a place called Timbuktu, of all things, another place called Skunk Hollow. I think that Hannah Crafts lived in one of these black communities, that she was, as she claims to be, a school teacher at the end, and that she was married to a Methodist minister. And more diligent research, I think, will discover the identity of her husband and of herself. Somewhere there is a scrap of paper. They have paid some tax. There is a birth of some child. There is a death certificate of somebody. And that person's identity will emerge. I deeply believe that, and that's why I'm hoping to facilitate that search by publishing the results of my research as openly, with as many qualifications as I can.
Henry Louis Gates will be back in the second half of the show. The manuscript he's edited is called The Bondwoman's Narrative by Hannah Crafts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Jon Favreau. He wrote the movies Swingers and Maid and starred in them with Vince Vaughn. Now he has a new series on the Independent Film Channel. Also, we continue our conversation with Henry Louis Gates about authenticating a novel purportedly written by a fugitive slave. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Henry Louis Gates, the chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. He's edited a manuscript that he believes is the first novel written by a black woman and the first by a fugitive slave. He bought the manuscript at an auction, did a lot of work authenticating it, and has now published it with his introduction. It's called The Bondwoman's Narrative by Hannah Crafts.
One of the things you wanted to be sure of was that this book was actually written by an African-American and not a white person. And you say one of the things that really demonstrates that is the way that the African-American characters are introduced, which is very different from the way white writers of the period introduce African-American characters. Would you describe some of the differences you discerned?
In the history of the novel, there were maybe a dozen instances out of the hundreds and hundreds of slave narratives and representations of slavery. There are only about a dozen instances of a white author using a black persona or claiming a black persona. But even in those cases, the person outed themselves very, very quickly. Most famous examples, Mattie Griffiths, 1856, she published the autobiography of a female slave. But within 3 weeks, I mean, pretending to be a black woman, but within 3 weeks, everyone knew who she was. One of the reasons that you have to copyright your work, it's copyrighted in her name, et cetera, et cetera. But that's external evidence. Internal evidence, which you're referring to, is equally telling. In fact, sometimes more telling, more damning. For example, each of those dozen white authors, plus Harriet Beecher Stowe, when they introduce a black character, they would say, here comes, you know, old woolly-headed Terry Gross, or here comes African-featured Uncle Tom, which is basically a quote from Harriet Beecher Stowe. Whiteness is the default, not blackness, so that as soon as the character shows up, they identify the character as being black through their either their color or their facial features or the texture of their hair. And this is entirely consistent throughout these dozen pseudo-slave narratives. Hannah Crafts, by contrast, makes blackness the default. When she introduces a black character, they're just a human being. And then later you realize that they are black, like maybe a couple paragraphs later or a couple pages later. The person who pointed this out to me was Dorothy Porter. I mean, Dorothy Porter was dead by the time I bought this manuscript. But in her notes, she said, I am convinced that this woman's black for two reasons. First of all, because of her realistic depictions of slave life in Virginia. And secondly, because she treats Negro characters as human beings first and as Negroes second. And that haunted me. I didn't know exactly what she meant. And I read the novel and read the novel. You know, I've now read the novel a dozen times. And then I realized there was a whole pattern here. So I went back to Uncle Tom's Cabin. And as you know from my footnotes and the introduction, I contrast Harriet Beecher Stowe's depiction of black people with Hannah Crafts' black people. And they're completely different. They're just totally opposite. And that suggested to me that this was an African-American author as well.
Is there a line that you can read or paraphrase from Uncle Tom's Cabin and from the book you've just published, The Bondwoman's Narrative, that illustrate what you're talking about here, the way a white writer of the period introduced black characters and the way this black writer introduced black characters?
Sure. In Uncle Tom's Cabin, Mose and Pete, who are Uncle Tom and Aunt Chloe's sons, she describes as a couple of woolly-head boys. Aunt Chloe has what she calls, quote, a round, black, shining face. And Uncle Tom himself is a full, glossy black, and that's a direct quote, possessing, quote, a face with truly African features, unquote. Now, all these descriptions come as soon as those characters enter the novel. Now, listen to this. This is from chapter 18 called Strange Company, and our dear Hannah is running away, and this is what she says. I cannot tell how long I had slumbered. I had no means of knowing, but it must have been for some time, when I was unaccountably wakened by a noise of an unusual kind. Raising myself on my elbow, I looked around and listened. The moon had risen, partially dispelling the darkness, and casting long bright streaks of light amid the thick mass of shadows. Nearby was a little opening in the branches, through which streamed a large patch of radiance. And to that, my eyes instinctively turned. Directly crossing this were the figures of two people. They were speaking, and the voices were those of a man and a woman. We will rest here, said the man. I think we can do so in perfect safety. And you are so ill and weary. His companion heaved a deep sigh. "This will be my last resting place. This dreadful fever is consuming me. I feel weaker and weaker every moment, and before morning, I shall be unable to rise." Well, it turns out, you keep reading and you turn the page, and it turns out that that man and that woman are black. Completely the opposite of the mode of representation used by Harriet Beecher Stowe and those dozen white authors who adopted a black persona. And that's what Dorothy Porter meant, and that was pretty telling proof to me. So if you think about it, we had internal evidence such as that, as well as intimate knowledge of slavery, and particularly the relationships between a mistress and a female slave. Lots of counterintuitive observations throughout this book that, in my opinion, only a slave would know. So there's no doubt in my mind that this was a black woman. And Joe Nichols points out that her handwriting is just serviceable. It's not the elegant, refined, tiny script used by upper-class Victorian white ladies in the North. It's the handwriting and the language, including, you know, hundreds and hundreds of misspellings of and punctuation errors of an autodidact, someone who is self-trained, someone who's very, very intelligent, has a native intelligence, someone who has exposure to books in a decent middle-class library, but who lacks formal education. And that's our Hannah Crafts, African-American female, and our first novelist.
After you published an essay in The New Yorker in February about authenticating this book, a couple of readers wrote in letters pointing out that there were a couple of passages in this book that seemed to be borrowed from Charles Dickens' Bleak House. What questions or issues did that raise for you?
Well, it's first of all, I was so grateful that the person who was pointed this out to me first was a graduate student at Princeton in the English department called Hollis Robbins, who's a very brilliant person and a Dickens scholar. And she sent me an email asking if I realized that Hannah Crafts had borrowed from Charles Dickens' Bleak House. And I said no, that I hadn't realized that. I had been looking for echoes from Uncle Tom's Cabin and from the other slave narratives. But I wasn't thinking about Charles Dickens, and I wasn't thinking about Dickens, I'm embarrassed to say, because none of the slave narrators had ever echoed or borrowed from Charles Dickens. Dickens just was not a source. And I sent my working introduction, my textual annotations, and the text of the novel, that is the type version of the manuscript, to a dozen major scholars throughout the United States, and none of them heard the echoes either. So we all had egg on our face, and we're all grateful that that Hollis Robbins pointed this out. And now, you know, dozens of Dickens scholars and Dickens fans have written to me to say this person was influenced by Charles Dickens. But I think that's marvelous. I mean, think about the democracy implied by in our great Republic of Letters. That here's a slave, a black woman, who had been so abused and traduced, and who had lived in Virginia, Washington, and North Carolina. She escapes to the North. She sits down to write an account of her bondage. And who does she turn to use as a template? Well, among others, she turns to Charles Dickens and his novel Bleak House. Now, Terry, one of the most marvelous aspects of doing the research for this book is the fact that another graduate student, a man named Brian Sinch, who's writing a dissertation under William Andrews at the University of North Carolina, was going through John Hill Wheeler's papers, which are housed both at the Library of Congress and at the University of North Carolina, doing research for me for this project to see, you know, what we might find. Was there any reference to Hannah Crafts? You know, whatever might be there. And he called me one day, and he was so excited because he said he had found Wheeler's handwritten listing, that is his catalog, of the books in his library circa 1850. And do you know that list included 4 books by Charles Dickens? And not only that, we later found an 1880 published catalog when after Wheeler's dead and his estate's being auctioned off. And we found, in addition to more Dickens, we found maybe 10 or 12 slave narratives in his library. Never before have we had access to the books that a slave could possibly have read in our master's library. And this is as exciting as anything else that we've found.
because Hannah Crafts was self-educated. She had a lot of spelling errors and grammatical errors. The text was handwritten. There were a lot of things that were crossed out. How much of that did you want to feature in the published edition of her book?
We featured it almost exactly as she wrote it. All of the crossing outs are there, as you've seen. We just print the words and we draw the line through them. She didn't put periods at the end of her sentences, so we say that we put periods there to keep the reader from getting mixed up. And she didn't put quotation marks around direct discourse all the time, and we use square brackets to indicate any quotation mark or any other change that we made in the manuscript. But essentially, we replicated the manuscript as faithfully as we possibly could to the condition in which I received it. I wanted it to be basically a facsimile, but set in type. That was important. The reason it's important is that this is the only manuscript written by a slave that we can be sure was not edited by an abolitionist or an amanuensis. All the others, or most of the others, were edited to some extent, even if only to correct grammar, as most of the editors or amanuenses would say. Even Frederick Douglass or Harriet Jacobs was edited by Lydia Maria Child to some extent. We don't know the extent. Here, as the great historian at Yale, David Brian Davis, says in a sort of a blurb for the book, we have the unedited consciousness of a slave for the first time. It's like we're sitting, she's sitting at her kitchen table, she's writing, and we are reading over her shoulder. And that's quite exciting. And there are many things in this book which will disturb people. For example, it's full of sex. I mean, by the standards of the 1850s, it's triple X rated. And I'm sure that the abolitionists would have edited this out if they had gotten their hands on this manuscript. She talks very explicitly about sexual relations between a master and his various mistresses, and how his wife discovers the sexual liaisons and forces him to kick all these mistresses out and the babies that they have, et cetera, et cetera. And also, she's quite explicit about the class differences between house servants and field servants. And this, I think, will bother a lot of black people. She talks about people who smell bad, or people who are ignorant, or people who are duplicitous. She's very much a snob. She's very aware of her privileged position. She's almost like an archetype of the tragic mulatto heroine who will emerge more especially at the turn of the century in fiction such as those written by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, a novel called Iola Leroy, or in the works of Charles Chestnut.
Well, Henry Louis Gates, thank you so much for talking with us about the bondwoman's narrative. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Henry Louis Gates edited the manuscript The Bondwoman's Narrative by Hannah Crafts. It's just been published with an introduction by Gates. He's the chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jon Favreau is best known for writing the independent movie Swingers and for starring in it with Vince Vaughn. The film was set in the world of Vegas and Hollywood clubs and lounges. Vaughn played a guy who thinks he's very cool and tries to show the more insecure Favreau how to meet attractive women. Favreau also starred with Vaughn in the crime comedy Maid, which Favreau wrote and directed. Now Favreau has his own series on the independent film channel called Dinner for Five. On each edition, he and four guests from the movie world have dinner at a restaurant and talk about movies and whatever else is on their minds. The series premieres on Monday. The first edition features Vince Vaughn, Gary Shandling, Peter Falk, and Sherry O'Terry. Here's Favreau introducing a new topic.
They have puppy play days in Hollywood, which I've never heard of before.
Only in
somebody invites you over to play, to have your dogs play, but there's only a certain age group and you are not allowed.
They have to be, yeah, a certain age group, because sometimes puppies, if they're let with a bunch of other adult dogs and they haven't had all their shots yet, they can catch something. So
you chose to adopt?
Yes, I did. Because I can't have a dog of my own.
Yeah, it's so hard to have a dog. You can't actually have a dog. You can't have a dog. So that's you actually, they leave you no choice but to That's why dogs have low self-esteem and will you know, listen to what you say and everything. Because they're lucky to have a home.
Uh-huh.
Now, but your dog is half chow and half...
Not half and half. It's mostly, I think, golden retriever, but no one really knows.
But that's interesting to me because the chow, I think, bites more people than any other breed of dog.
No,
but then you have a
that's a misunderstanding.
No,
don't forget about
that.
I'm mad at that, too. I'm mad at that, too. I'm sick of that.
The conversations on Dinner for Five are set around a restaurant table, but eating isn't the most flattering time to be filmed. I asked Favreau if his guests really eat during the shoot.
People actually do eat, and it's actually dinner time, and part of it is, you know, we just have the cameras rolling before the people sit down. They're mic'd already. The cameras are far away. And the idea is to sort of lull people into the feeling that they're just having dinner and not being observed. You know, of course, it's impossible to replicate. But part of the reason that I think it works is because everybody that comes on the show, I'd say like 90% of the people I'm either friends with or I've worked with, and they trust that I'm not going to cut in shots that are unflattering. If they say anything that they regret later, I'll cut it out. And the goal really is to make the people as relaxed and as comfortable as they can. I like to surround people with people that they've worked with before, people they're friends with, and try to sort of simulate the atmosphere of just being, you know, at a dinner party with a bunch of friends.
Now, you're best known for writing and starring in Swingers and for writing, starring in, and directing Maid. Where was your career heading before those films? What kind of parts were you being given?
Well, I'd moved from New York to Chicago and become an improviser, done improv comedy, and I got my big break in a film called Rudy, my first starring role. And I moved from Chicago out to Los Angeles on sort of the heels of that success. And I got an agent, and I had made it in my estimation. It was beyond anything that any of the people that I had been working with in Chicago ever dreamed could happen, because, you know, it's a big part in a big movie. I moved out to Hollywood, and, you know, the landscape was a little more bleak than I had anticipated. I thought I had it made, and I just sort of was at level one. You know, there was another mountain beyond the mountain. And a year after I had moved to Los Angeles, I had met Vince Vaughn on the set of Rudy. We had been hanging out, and I wrote a script based on somebody who was in L.A. for just for 6 months and who had gotten over a relationship, which I had as well. And that turned into the script for Swingers.
If you went to a club after making Swingers, did you find that women who had seen the movie related to you any differently?
Yes. They were far more open to sleeping with me than before I was famous, I found, surprisingly enough.
To put it bluntly, yeah.
Yeah, that's basically the biggest difference was, you know, you go from somebody who was a character actor who nobody knew, who, you know, really it was like a sore thumb in Los Angeles coming from Chicago where I was living at the time and had no sense of style or anything. And then I moved to Los Angeles. And now all of a sudden I'm famous for whatever that's worth. And, you know, me just in the nature, I always went from long relationship to long relationship, but it was nice to be flirted with. It was nice to have women available to me. And I ended up meeting my wife really in that period, because I would only go short stretches of dating more than like one person. And I think that much like the character in Swingers, I really, I don't think that I was in a happy place when I was single. It's nice to be in a good relationship. And I have to say that now that I'm married and I have an 8-month-old boy named Max, it makes me so much more open creatively.
So how did you meet your wife? Was that at a club?
I met her at a bar. And I was like on a first date or a second date with somebody who I had very little in common with. And the woman who later became my wife came up to me just to say hello and that she liked the movie. And she told her mom to see Swingers because she had just moved to Los Angeles. And I thought she was an actress, like 90% of the women you meet in Hollywood. And it turned out that she was a doctor, which was intriguing to me. And she made such an impression on me in the short conversation we had that I ended up calling up the hospital where she worked and getting her pager number and getting a hold of her. And we ended up going on, out to dinner. And I stopped being interested in seeing other people. And we were together for a long time. And we've been married now for over a year. And we have a little boy.
Now, you grew up in Queens, New York. I believe you're half Italian and half Jewish?
Yeah.
do you connect certain traits in your personality or sensibility to being Italian and being Jewish?
Yeah, for sure. I think they both have a similar sense of family, extended family, a certain comfort level when it comes to eating with a lot of people.
As you're doing in your TV show, right?
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason I'm doing Dinner for Five is so much of the whole idea of storytelling, not just storytelling, but watching somebody order, watching who takes over the table when the waiter comes, going to a restaurant and figuring out what the right thing to order is. That's a very Italian thing. It's a very Jewish thing, too. There's a lot of pride taking at mealtimes.
Were you brought up either as a Catholic or as a Jew? Did you observe either?
I was brought up as a Jew, more so. Actually, I wasn't directed in any particular direction. I did go to Hebrew school for a while.
Uh-huh.
My father's very, very, I would call him at this point probably a devout Catholic. I know my grandmother certainly was. Catholicism was an important part of her life. Whereas Judaism wasn't that big of an element, except for culturally on my mother's side of the family. But I lost my mother when I was 11 or 12. I was young. And I think that drew me closer to that religion. And I certainly relate more to that culture.
My guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Jon Favreau. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker and actor Jon Favreau. He's best known for his films Made and Swingers. Now he has a new series on the Independent Film Channel called Dinner for Five, in which he and four guests sit around a dinner table and talk. You went to the Bronx High School of Science. Were you actually considering a science career before you pursued film?
Yeah, I wanted to be an engineer. I was going to go to Cooper Union. I was on the waiting list. It's a great school down by St. Mark's Place, a free school. Thanks to the endowment of the Aston Fortune. And I was on the waiting list. I didn't make it in, and I was going to go to CCNY, City College, for engineering, and I decided to stay at Queens College and do pre-engineering, and then I discovered beer and dating and college, and I slowly got sidetracked away from a career in academia. And I took the fire department test. I didn't get in here in New York, and then eventually, I went cross country on a Harley Davidson that I had bought after working a year on Wall Street, and I stopped in Chicago, and saw Mike Myers performing improv with Chris Farley, and a lot of people who are on Saturday Night Live now, and I said, "This is it. This is what I want to do." And I moved to Chicago, and the rest is history.
When you got to Chicago, you stayed for a while. One of the things you did was get a job washing dishes at the Improv.
At the Second City,
actually. At the Second City, oh, okay.
Right, okay. Where they do improv. The Improv is a stand-up club where they don't do improv, they do stand-up. And Second City is a cabaret theater where they do improvisation from time to time.
Were you able to, like, learn anything about comedy by being the dishwasher there? Did you have access to the things you wanted to learn?
Yeah, because I got free classes, and I studied there. I got to watch...
Do you have to do improv to get the job as the dishwasher? I mean, do you have to audition for that?
No, it's like everybody else. Everybody there wants to be on the stage, on the main stage at Second City, because that's where Belushi was and Bill Murray and all the people you look up to, and you want to be just like them and get on the main stage and get plucked off and go on Saturday Night Live and live the dream. And while I was there making my bones and trying to get noticed by the people, I was washing dishes in the kitchen attached to the green room of the main stage. And at that time, Chris Farley was there and Tim Meadows. And it was just hilarious what would go on backstage when they were changing costumes. You have Chris Farley running around naked, making everybody laugh. It was quite a scene. And at the time, you don't really appreciate it. But now you look back, and now that everybody's moved on to bigger and better things, or tragically, like in the case of Chris, no longer with us, you really look back and appreciate what was going on. And it feels like almost like, you know, when they talk about the writer's room on your show of shows, or, you know, the Algonquin Roundtable. You know, at the time, I don't think those moments really felt like anything that special. But with the nostalgia as time passes and careers are formed, you realize that those moments when you were just, when I was up to my, you know, up to my elbows in suds, waiting for, you know, to check out and get out onto the street, that was probably the time when I was learning the most about comedy, watching the improv sets every night, you know, as I was seating people in the main room. And that was a tremendous place to learn, because when you're doing improv, you're not just learning how to act or be funny. You're learning timing. You're learning to listen to the audience. You're creating your own material as you perform it. You're editing your own material. You're ending scenes when they should end, and you learn about editing, directing, writing, acting. And so when I made the transition from acting into writing and then later directing, it was a very easy transition that I had already sort of made, because I had already worked in sketch comedy for so long.
I understand you're writing a Western about a Hasidic Jewish gunfighter.
Yes, that actually it's written. That movie I wrote when we were editing Swingers, and that was the project that Vince and I wanted to do right after Swingers. Problem is, financing a Western is hard enough. Financing one that features a very violent Hasidic Jewish gunfighter is even more difficult.
This is a comedy?
They don't know what it's. Yeah, it's a comedy, but it's very true to the Western form, and it's been characterized as an anteater, which is a term for a film that people don't know what to do with or how to market. So it becomes a very dangerous bet. But as Vince and I become more marketable commodities in Hollywood, and as this becomes this is our biggest endeavor, is to get this film made, you will see it hit the screen at some point.
Well, Jon Favreau, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure. I'm a listener, and I'm so proud to be on your show. Thanks a lot.
Jon Favreau's new series on the Independent Film Channel is called Dinner for Five. It premieres Monday with encore presentations on Wednesday and Saturday. His movie, Made, is now out on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Mones, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, poet Donald Hall. His new collection of poems is about life after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. The book begins with this quote, "The true subject of poetry is the loss of the beloved." I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.